Good afternoon. I'm really delighted to welcome you to this third lecture of the 2008 Evolution in Medicine Lecture Series. For starters, we have a sign language expert here, and if you need sign language interpretation, please let us know. Okay. No one yet. I want to remind you that there's one more lecture in this series. It will be 2 weeks from today, June 24th, and the speaker will be Dr. Joe Thornton, who will be talking about the evolution of protein function. Now, this year, we have featured several young investigators doing research on the real cutting edge of evolutionary sciences. And today, we're going to talk about a really exciting topic, which is evolution in the microbial world. This is a field that is rapidly expanding, both because of the incredible diversity of the microbial world and because it's possible to engineer microbes and do experimental evolution in the laboratory. So today we'll be hearing about the evolution of diverse physiological capacities in bacteria and how that diversity is maintained. Our speaker is Dr. Christopher Marks, who's currently an assistant professor at Harvard University. He completed his undergraduate work in environmental engineering and biology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and his doctoral work was done in microbiology with Mary Lidstrom at the University of Washington in 2003. He did 2 years of postdoctoral training with Rich Litsky at Michigan State University before taking his current position at Harvard. Chris?
Thank you very much. Well, it's a great pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for the kind invitation. I look forward to telling about my work and, gratuitous F1 photo. So let's see here. I had a nice time coming down here. I got to see my former president of my institution at Harvard was on the same plane, and I got to see him give great grief to the gate agent as to why our plane was late and have the gate agent pull the pilot off the plane and explain to him why we weren't leaving on time. Wasn't particularly out of character, I unfortunately have to say. And in a second amusing moment as I was driving from the airport to here in the cab and I saw the turnoff for the George Bush Center for Intelligence. That also gave so there's some irony there, I'm sure. So today I'm going to talk about evolution in biological systems, and if such a title, if anybody has any idea what this is actually about, I'd be surprised. It's somewhat perhaps broad. So what I really want to try to get at is the integration between physiology, systems biology, however you want to phrase it, and evolution. And I think most of biomedical sciences has been interested in the integration of what basically makes cellular phenotypes and how do they change. And either cellular, tissue, you know, whole organisms, how the genotype and the environment interact to give us, you know, particular phenotypes, whether this be disease, health, et cetera. And so, you know, for most of you, perhaps the model organism you think of is something like this. I noticed today as I put this up here that given the relative proportion of the various body parts, this must be the self-image of a PI. My organism is something more like this. I'm a microbiologist. But I think the questions are certainly just as applicable. And so coming from my latter training in evolutionary biology and ecology and some of the work that I'm doing now and colleagues, we're interested in a variety of questions that kind of dodge the difficult bits that were on the prior slide. And we're interested in how selection acts upon particular phenotypes, and contributes to the fitness or the reproductive success of organisms, how, in ecology, how the phenotypes of organisms, how they interact with each other and they interact with their environment to determine this reproductive success, and then the various population dynamic processes that go to change frequencies of genotypes and how mutations introduce new genotypes into this picture. And so what I'd like to suggest is that it's possible, particularly with amenable systems such as microbes in the lab, to try to connect all of these various pieces and do the molecular cellular work in a system where you can also address ecology and evolution. And I think, you know, we're clearly in a time where we need more words and phrases and fields, you know, something to add to our phrase-ome. So I'd like to suggest a new phrase, biology. And I think that this is really, I mean, this is everything, how systems work and how they interact with each other in their environment and how they change over time. And I think that this is really, you know, I think what the goal of biology should be ultimately, and certainly different people can play different parts, or some people can try to be ridiculous and play all the parts, but ultimately to kind of put this picture together. And so, given the difficulty, I've taken kind of the simplest possible approach, as I'm dancing around my chords here. And so I use the simplest possible kind of environment, you know, a single bacteria in a single nutrient environment in a test tube. And so it gives me all the kind of the powers of reductionist biology kind of from the top part of the slide that allow me to do genetic analysis, biochemical analyses, do physiological experiments, but within the context of a laboratory environment where the environment is completely artificial. What goes on within that flask through subsequent transfers, that's natural selection. It's ecological interactions between various genotypes in the population, et cetera. And so now I saw a snippet of some of the prior talks, and despite some of the compelling words, I don't know if anybody you saw those, compelling words from great philosophers of our time like Kirk Cameron, hopefully you know, many in the audience here believe that evolution is something that is worth considering. And I think it's particularly critical in medicine. And I think the area that is perhaps kind of most timely in that it occurs on a timeline that affects us the most is in the area of infectious disease. Whether we're talking about immune evasion of various pathogens, evolution of resistance to various drugs and antibiotics, and even cancer. I mean, I think cancer is worth thinking of as being somatic adaptation. What we consider as, oncogenes and tumor suppressor genes, mutations there, they're essentially, from the point of view of that tissue, they're beneficial mutations. They're outgrowing their neighbors. It's not that different than what's going on in my flasks. And so I think it's very important to consider not just the function of how the interacting functional parts work within these systems, but also the evolutionary dynamics that can occur. And so the question that I want to present today is one that is perhaps somewhat unusual, and I think is rather absurd, but I think is very important. Is, can adaptation be predicted? What would it take to actually be able to predict, adaptive steps before they happened? And so what do I mean by that? That could be many things. Will adaptation occur? You could just ask it as a yes or no question. If it's a big enough population size, and if there's genetic variation for, if there are beneficial mutations that are possible, the answer will probably be yes. You could also ask in terms of the rate, how fast will adaptation occur, et cetera. And that's also an interesting question, but I'm interested in something a little bit different. I want to know, if I put a particular genotype in a particular environment, what's the relative likelihood, if we kind of think about kind of a probability distribution of what is the likelihood of seeing the first beneficial mutation in gene, A, B, C, D, et cetera, throughout the genome. And then perhaps after one or more mutations have taken place within this background, or you put it into a different environment, ask how does this change now in terms of what are the relative likelihoods now of seeing later mutations occur in those new backgrounds or in those new environments. And so I think this is a ridiculously hard problem, and I'm certainly not going to present a solution, but I think it's an interesting one, and I think it can be tractable. Sometimes it can even be trivial. And so one case would be when you put bacteria under antibiotic selection, where resistance mutations are point mutations to the targets themselves. If I throw my bug down on rifamycin or streptomycin, things like this, you'd get a picture that looks kind of like this, where there's really only one gene that controls fitness in that particular environment. Great, I can predict adaptation, but it's not a very interesting case. You can imagine the opposite, where that would lead to things being completely random, where you could have many, many genes all matter a very, very small amount. Nothing matters all that much. And so what you'll end up seeing then will just be completely rolling the dice in terms of chance, in terms of which things will be mutated first. And I'd suggest that the reality is some picture that looks a little bit more like up here, that it's somewhere in between. Some things are certainly going to matter more in a particular environment, some things are going to matter less. The question is really, is this something, this distribution, knowable? What would it take to be able to predict the relative likelihoods of where adaptation is going to strike? And I think, in principle, I think this is a phenomenally interesting question. This would be kind of an answer to that larger picture of biology, where you don't know just how the organism functions, but you're able to actually make predictions in terms of how that organism will change in time. why would we care? I think it has particular relevance, especially in medicine. You can imagine, for example, if you have a tumor polyp beginning to grow that has, three mutations in oncogenes or tumor suppressors. You could ask, given that constellation of mutations that are already present, perhaps the genetic background of the individual, other things in terms of that kind of affects the environment of that cell, what can you say anything about what the relative likelihood of the later mutations are going to be to this growing body of cells? And this would be mutations that can either be looked for prognostically, or perhaps it could be treatments that directly target the things that are most likely to come up next. And so that is obviously an environment in which knowing this would be quite relevant, but also would be exceedingly difficult given today's level of knowledge. Stepping back, what would, for this kind of ridiculous idea of being able to predict adaptation before it occurred, what would you need to know? And I think there's kind of actually about four levels of information you need. It sounds like a diet plan. It's a four-step program. And these different bits are the following. First, you need to know how much fitness increase could you achieve by changing kind of the individual parts. And where in the system can you get your biggest bang for your buck? But that's if you could change anything, what's most sensitive. But you're not changing them. Neither is a flying spaghetti monster. It's mutations. And so the second part of that you need to know is what's the relative distribution of mutations upon the parameters of these various parts. How much can mutations affect regulatory proteins? Can they affect enzymes, etc.? And at what rates? If you knew this, and if you knew this, you'd actually have this kind of mythical beast in evolutionary biology called the distribution of fitness effects, which is all the potential effects of mutations that can occur throughout a genome. This would be great, but even this would not be enough to tell you what's going to actually occur in a given population. Because even if you knew everything that was possible, the question is, what does it take to actually win? Is it always going to have to be that biggest effect mutation? Or anything that's simply beneficial at all? And so you end up having to know about population dynamics to know what are the actual chances that a mutation is going to be able to compete successfully given what's going on and be able to compete for fixation. Basically, in a small population, anything that's beneficial and escapes initial drift will have a chance to rise in frequency and perhaps go to fixation before the next beneficial mutation comes along. This is the so-called strong selection, weak mutation, or one locus type of model. On the other hand, if you have a large population, you're going to have many different beneficial mutations all arising and competing with each other. And this does two things. First, is you have many good things all rising, they actually slow each other's fixation because now you're not just competing against the bad ancestor, you're competing against other cells that are good, but it also effectively sorts through the mutations so that, in a bigger pool, you have to be a bigger fish to actually come to win. And even that's not enough. Because in a large population, and certainly for the various infectious disease examples I gave you before, with the possible exception of cancer, that we're talking about large populations on the order, typically on the order of millions, billions, etc. If it's big enough for different beneficial mutations to have to compete with each other, it also means that it's going to take long enough that within those backgrounds, new mutations are going to begin to occur. And so you'd also have to know how do subsequent mutations epistatically interact with those in the contending genotypes, in that mutations are going to end up kind of stacking on top of each other and landing on each other's shoulders. And the question is, how are these going to end up interacting with each other in a population? And so, effectively, this is somewhat the outline of my talk today, with the exception of Area 3. We're beginning a project where we're trying to look at the distribution of fitness effects at various population sizes, but it's just begun. I'm largely going to talk about the top two, though, in terms of trying to understand and ultimately try to predict what's the fitness consequence of being able to change various parts in a biological system, and what are the actual mutations that we then end up seeing occurring within an evolving population. So my particular area that I look at is metabolism. And I think metabolism is nice because even though it may be very difficult to do, one can think about metabolic systems in a very quantitative way in terms of the levels and parameters of enzymes, concentrations of metabolites, flux going through a system. It's something that can be very nice, nicely ended up making into a quantified model. So there's kind of, though, if you look at kind of a cell level phenotype, like growth rate, and as I'll mention, in my experiments where you do evolution in a flask, growth rate is the primary thing that selection tends to operate upon. There are multiple kind of intermediate phenotypes that get you from the genotype, some mutation, to some change in growth rate. And if you're talking about a metabolic system, the first is how does mutation affect kind of the enzyme levels or properties? Does it affect its Vmax or its Km, et cetera, of various enzymes? And what effect does this have? This is what changes then the flux going through various pathways, or as well as the concentration of the metabolites in those pathways themselves. And so in looking at adaptation in these sort of systems, I'm interested then, following from the prior slide, how strong can selection act? How strong does it act upon the various enzymes within a particular subsystem? What's the distribution of effects and type of mutations that occur that affect these enzymes? How large of a selective effect does it take to actually end up being a winner and showing up and rising frequency in a population? And then how do these beneficial mutations end up interacting with each other? And so my model system is a bacterium. It happens to be a plant epiphyte. It lives on the surface of leaves. This is if you take a clover leaf and put it onto a plate that just has methanol as a carbon source, you get this nice pink constellation of colonies. So methylobacterium. Has anybody ever heard of methylobacterium here? One, yeah. You've looked at my website, but yes, you know. So it may be, you know, I like to think it is a model system. It's just a non-traditional model system. It's actually been a model system for 50 years for understanding methylotrophy, and methylotrophy, from which it derives its name, is the ability to grow on single carbon compounds. And so these can be things like methane, methanol, methylamines, etc. And what is in common about all the various ways that bacteria use to grow on single carbon compounds is they get oxidized to formaldehyde, every single carbon, and then the formaldehyde is further oxidized to CO2, and it's assimilated at a variety of different oxidation levels, depending on the exact system present, into biomass. And so, of course, there's this kind of unique aspect. This is formaldehyde. Didn't I mention that? This is exceedingly toxic. And so to grow fast, and like I said, growth rate is what's being selected upon, at least in my environment. I'm not talking about the leaf in terms of when I talk about selective effects today, but my artificial environment, but the natural selection that goes on within there. So there's selection to grow fast, but if you build up a large pool of formaldehyde, your cells can become a chip-chip experiment in no time flat. And you can actually calculate that if you were to stop using formaldehyde but keep making it, every second the concentration would build by about 2 millimolar inside the cell. So it would not take long to run into great problems. And so this looks fairly simple. And I'll show you. Know, it's simple if I draw it like this. You'll see later. It can be more complicated. It requires actually about 100 genes to be a methylotroph. But if you look across, and there are methylotrophs in a wide, wide variety of taxa. They're not specifically related to each other. And so you might think this is something that emerged many independent times, but it turns out not to be the case. It's a case where a complex, like I said, 100-gene metabolic system has been passed around through horizontal gene transfer. And so we have large islands in our bugs of like about 25 kb for one, 60 kb for another, etc., that are genes that have been acquired through horizontal gene transfer. And the other interesting thing is almost all methylotrophs that we know have actually become very highly specialized. And so there appears to be a trade-off. At least this is what we observe in nature, that those bugs that have kept the ability to grow on single carbon compounds, almost all of them are either obligately grow on single carbon compounds or grow on a very limited subset of other compounds. And I have other projects in the lab that we've addressed looking at the evolution of trade-offs and specialization. I'd be happy to talk later about that with people, but I don't have time today. And additionally, we have two genome sequences available now, including the strain that I work with, but I'm also leading a consortium to analyze a genome of six additional strains collectively with these two that have a wide variety of various niches, and these are being done with JGI, and a number of collaborators are working on this analysis. So, like I said, I do experimental evolution. This can be done in a wide variety of ways. Like I said, the environment is essentially arbitrary. You can pick how it is you want to do things, but essentially this is a genetic screen for fitness is one way of thinking about it. And just like any genetic screen, you get what you're asked for, even if it's not what you thought. Different environments ask for different traits. In my case, we inoculate flasks of fresh media, let them grow up, in this case every 2 days, and then we transfer 1/64th. So they do six doublings every 2 days. And so in this environment, in a flask, selection is largely upon growth rate. It can also operate on lag if the time to start to get into exponential growth is particularly long. And if the cells die in stationary phase, you can select against that too. But in this case, that they don't die very much in stationary phase, so there's nothing to select upon there. And importantly, I think what makes experimental evolution probably the most important aspect of the whole thing is that we can have a living fossil record, that you have your ancestor frozen away in a freezer. At different time points, what doesn't get passed along, you save in the freezer. And so you have this fossil record that you can go back to retroactively. And so as you find new information, as new technologies, like I'll talk about the sequencing technology that we're using now, et cetera, come around, new ideas, you can go back to your old populations and revive them, pull them back into the environment they evolved in, or test them in other environments if you want, and ask these questions. And the ability to separate in time doing the first experiment and doing the later experiments is fantastically useful. And so the other thing that I think is really important about lab and evolution is that we can define an assay fitness. And we're not just counting, you know, how many berries does a bush have, or, you know, how long do hatchlings live, or something like that. We can actually kind of integrate across all parts of a growth phase and look at the relative fecundity of one type to the other by doing a competition assay, which is something that in bacterial pathogenesis has certainly become more common now, to actually see people comparing two different genotypes together, not just looking alone. And it's the same basic idea where you can acclimate your, for example, your evolved isolate, and we've taken our ancestral strain and we've made a fluorescently labeled version of it, acclimate them through a couple cycles of growth in the conditions you want to test, mix them together, and have them grow together for one or perhaps more cycles if there's a subtle difference. And importantly now, it's very easy to quantify the ratio of these two different types. In this case, we use flow cytometry. And so we can very easily gate the fluorescent cells and the non-fluorescent cells. And by this change in the ratio, by looking kind of at the proportional increase that was seen for these two different genotypes over how many generations occurred, we can calculate fitness, which will show up as a W throughout. And you get some number, so like 1.1 would mean that you're 10% better per generation, 10% more fecund than your competitor.
How do you prevent horizontal gene transfer?
Ah, good question. And I actually should also mention, please feel free to ask questions throughout as well as the end. So it depends on what system you start with. Some people purposely want to see horizontal transfer go on, and so they use strains that are naturally competent or include phage or plasmids. So our strain has no phage or prophage present, and it has plasmids, but they're not self-transmissible. And so, you know, you could have kind of the miraculous event. It's not a naturally competent strain, but so far, at least, throughout the field, there's been no evidence for these sorts of events occurring.
So you could have these under antibiotic pressure the entire time to maintain plasmids?
No. So do we need an antibiotic selective pressure? In this case, no. So I'll talk about, actually, for the strain that we're using, there it has some endogenous plasmids that are, they're just there. They're on their own in terms of whether they want to hang around. And actually, as you'll see, one of them went away. But the plasmid that I introduced a foreign metabolic pathway on, the environment itself selects for the metabolic genes present on that pathway, so I don't need to add, in this case, kanamycin to keep the plasmid there. As you'll see, though, things actually went funky with the plasmid. It actually ended up being quite interesting, and I'll mention that later. So the particular system that I use, then I'll transition straight to this, is one of an engineered horizontal gene transfer. And in this case, I do the horizontal transfer, and then I'm asking in the cells for subsequent adaptation to it. And so the model system, here's the wild-type methylobacterium, growth on methanol, makes formaldehyde. Almost all of it gets oxidized to a pathway to formate, to CO2, and the formate is largely where assimilation occurs from. If you take out this pathway, this formaldehyde oxidation pathway, the cells can't grow on methanol, and actually the slightest fume, and they stop growing. They can grow on like 100 millimolar or more, but a fume of 1 micromolar, and they stop growing. And so, again, with formaldehyde being an intermediate, they're quite sensitive to it. However, if you take it away, but replace it now with a foreign pathway, and so I've lifted a pathway from a different bacterium, that common ancestor to my bug was probably on the order of 2.5 billion years. And this is a non-orthologous pathway. This is not the same enzymes at all. They're not related. Different chemistry, different cofactor kind of utilization. But largely speaking, it does the same kind of thing. It gets you from formaldehyde to formate. And so the neat thing is, with this pathway in place, they can grow. They can grow again now on methanol. However, this specifically causes them to grow threefold slower. And they also have a reduction in yield. And so why does this matter? Why is this a good system to look at? Well, one is kind of the horizontal gene transfer angle, in that I'm interested in kind of, you know, one way of thinking of this project is kind of what happens a day after a horizontal transfer of something new, whether it be a large set of virulence genes, photosynthesis has been passed around, you know, methylotrophy, etc. But the other aspect is it's typically been very hard to make to have any idea what the targets of adaptation would be. And so, as was mentioned before, I did my postdoctoral work with Rich Linsky. He's evolved E. coli for now over 40,000 generations in minimal media with glucose. And so you think, all right, this is E. coli and glucose, right? I mean, we've known this since the times of, you know, Minot and Jacob, how they grow. And, you know, we know so much about the cells. We should be able to predict, even just qualitatively, what genes should matter. And we would have been horrifically wrong. There are beneficial mutations in, like, topoisomerase, in penicillin binding proteins, all sorts of aspects that aren't even metabolism. There are other physiological processes in the cell. So what's nice about this situation, our key hypothesis here, is that because this specific change takes cells that had a doubling time of 3.7 hours and it's now 11 hours, this specific change, putting one module for the other, targets it so that this is what is holding the cell back. And so we can think about metabolism, and we can even think about, like, this subpart of the system and not the entire cell. And hopefully this is both what we can be thinking about in terms of our modeling, in terms of our experiments, but this is also hopefully what adaptation is, so as to say, thinking about in terms of that this would be the aspect of physiology where beneficial mutations will occur rather than anything, and into a wide variety of processes that we have no idea how to think about yet. And so I've been collaborating on this project, and I should certainly mention, I'll mention at the end, but I should certainly mention now too, this is an NIH-funded R01 project, but I have a fantastic co-PI, Daniel Segre at Boston University, and together we've been building upon an earlier version of a model of this central C1 metabolism. So unfortunately the picture is not quite as clean as something like this. You know, our reaction network looks a little bit more like something like this. Becomes critically important, besides just looking at what carbon molecule goes to what new carbon molecule, the cofactors. You know, cells have dissimilatory metabolism for a reason. They make it, you know, not just to waste carbon, but to make ATP, make NADPH, things they need for biosynthetic reactions. And so the dissimilatory pathways make those cofactors, which end up then being used in kind of a conglomerate biosynthetic reaction to make biomass. And so this system is uglier than the picture before, but it's not this. Right? And so it's exactly because I'm starting with a particular system with this introduced pathway that the hypothesis is this is what matters and not, you know, I don't have to think about all of this. We do some modeling at this level, and I can talk more about it later. It's an area called flux balance analysis. It's useful. It's important to do bookkeeping to know how many NADPH and how many ATP do you actually need per carbon to make, you know, cell components at the proportions they're needed. But I'm not trying to model everything with a hypothesis that it's the flux through this pathway, and ultimately it's the flux that's entering biomass that's kind of the pace setter for the cell. That's kind of the key hypothesis in terms of enabling this project to work. And so how do we do this? It's a kinetic model where it's a system of ordinary differential equations using Michaelis-Menten kinetics, things like this. And so although it's a kinetic, you know, time-dependent model, we're following the concentrations of metabolites through time. You can ask what the various fluxes are. This very quickly, after an exceedingly short transient, achieves a steady state, which is analogous to exponential growth, where all the fluxes, the growth rate of the cell, the metabolic concentrations remain constant until the methanol in the model eventually goes and dips close enough to kind of the effective Km of the cell that things begin to slow down. And so it's exactly this exponential growth phase, which, like I mentioned, is the primary selective component when you're doing batch growth that we're trying to predict. And so it's a large system. There, in total, between kind of all the various pathways involved, there are 81 parameters. Luckily, 60 of these we have in vitro published data for. Like I said, this is a model system, just not as much as E. coli is. But it's important to note that, I mean, this was measuring enzyme activity, you know, in phosphate buffer, TRIS, etc. It's not to say that what you measure in vitro is going to exactly match up with in vivo, but at least it gives us a place to seed values in terms of doing parameter fitting. And so Daniel Segre's student, Shen Chao, has been working to develop a new genetic algorithm that can take into account many different kind of cellular phenotypes and be able to better fit these parameters. And the nice thing is it's kind of ends up becoming a question of internal consistency. And I think it's important to mention this is a model. This is not reality. But the point of a model is that you're trying to put forth, this is how I think a system works. Am I anywhere close to right on a quantitative level? And so I think it's more, you know, a question asker and generator, at least early on. And there are assumptions that go into it. You know, there are parameters that require more data to be able to fit well, but it forces us to make quantitative predictions, not just qualitative ones, and ask whether or not we are right, rather than trying to prove that we are. And so in terms of this fitting, we have data in terms of the flux going through various pathways, and it splits at various nodes, and we can, with the parameters that we're using, the experimental relative flux going through these various pathways matches up fairly well with the model, as well as the yield and as well as the doubling time of these cells in terms of what we measure experimentally and what we find in the model. And this is true. We've only been thinking of only two genotypes and only relatively few phenotypes. We've been thinking about the wild-type cells that have the original methanopteran pathway and these engineered ancestral cells that just received this foreign pathway. As we get more and more data, we'll have more and more situations in which to fit the model to. So why do we even need to make a model? And so the question here is that we're trying to use the model to ask questions of optimality. We want to know which parameters would be the best to optimize, which exert the greatest control over flux, not just kind of the local flux, but ultimately the flux into biomass. As you change various parts, how much does that flux into biomass change? And so this is, in terms of this relationship of enzyme parameters and flux, you know, you can have some simple system of a few metabolites and a few enzymes, and once this reaches steady state, the flux through each of these is going to be equal to each other, and you can ask, what would be the effect once you've reached a steady state of changing the level of just, say, one of these enzymes or another of these enzymes? If it's one enzyme in a tube and there's excess substrate, that's an enzyme assay. You double the enzyme, you double the flux. You quadruple it, you quadruple the flux. But when you have this sort of situation, once they're coupled up with each other, things are not so simple. And what you tend to see are kind of these quasi-hyperbolic curves that kind of quickly tend to saturate out. And for various enzymes, these curves, canonically, if you have pathways that look like this, will have this sort of shape. And what really ends up mattering is where on the curve are you? Are you at a point early on so that you're at an area where changes in an enzyme would have great effects on flux, or you're out on a shoulder where things don't matter very much? And so this is an area that perhaps some of you are familiar with. This is called metabolic control analysis. This is an area of theory that was developed back in the 70s in terms of simply coupling Michaelis-Menten equations and ask how these perform at steady state. And there was one of the key findings that came out from the very beginning of this is that if you look in any arbitrary subsystem, whether it has three enzymes or 300, at all of these control coefficients, if this is the relative change in flux through the system versus the relative change in the enzyme, if you add it up for all the enzymes in any single steady state, this is always equal to 1, the sum of these control coefficients. So again, whether it's one enzyme in a test tube and it's an enzyme assay, or if it's an entire cell growing, they always add up to 1. And so if it is that Roche map I showed before, there's hundreds of enzymes. It means that the average control coefficient in any single situation at steady state is very, very small. And so almost all enzymes exist in a single steady state, at least, in this sort of situation, such that quantitative variation in the level of enzymes tends to be relatively neutral for most. And one important aspect, and this helps explain why many metabolic diseases are recessive, because for most enzymes, you may need it, 0, and you don't grow at all. But if you have curves that have this particular shape, half is typically more than sufficient for the cell or for the individual to do just fine. So besides kind of this is kind of, to some extent in my talk, I suppose, it's kind of metabolic engineering in reverse. These curves tell us then about the quantitative potential for selection, in that if you're an enzyme that looks like this, there's nothing that I can do to you to change you to really get much effect in terms of the growth rate and the fitness of the organism. However, enzymes that have a sizable control coefficient, these become the reasonable targets. This is where you can get the big bang for the buck, not in those. And so, you know, with the current version of the model, we can then make predictions about control, where we change the relative Vmax and ask what effect does it have on fitness. And for most of these curves, you can see they flatline relatively quickly. There are a few, and I'll mention them, where that's not true. And so the nice thing is, so to some extent you could say this is a fishing experiment, because we're going to make predictions and then, all right, whatever you find in the experimental, you know, populations, that tells you something. But, you know, especially for these where they're flatliners, we're expecting to find nothing. And how do we know that the curve is even correct? Because these are really important tests for the model. And so the nice thing is we have a regulated promoter system with our bug. And so we can arbitrarily ourselves dial the enzymes up or down and ask in a controlled fashion whether we can reproduce these curves. And so we can both make the predictions, see how they compare, and then iteratively use that information to try to improve the model beyond there. And the thing I want to point out is that the greatest sensitivity actually is to reaction of formaldehyde with this new, the cofactor of this new pathway, which is glutathione. And interestingly, in this system, this is a non-enzymatic reaction. And this is where the aspect about it that has the greatest sensitivity, and I'll certainly come back to this, in terms of asking this question, you know, does what we predict have anything to do with what we observe in the adapting populations? So the populations themselves. You know, you could imagine, all right, you throw in this foreign pathway, they're not very good at growing, and there's really not much they can do about it. They're just bad. Luckily, this was not the case. They adapted actually quite rapidly. The average fitness went up to somewhere between 1.5 and 2 within just the first 100 plus generations. This is more than was observed in my mentor Rich Alinsky's E. coli experiment over 40,000 generations. Of course, you know, I'm starting these guys at a fitness well, so it's a little bit unfair to compare, but this is exceedingly fast adaptation in a population. And importantly, if you look at I've been trying to relate that flux into biomass is what sets growth rate, and growth rate largely sets fitness. And the nice thing is these three aspects all correlate very nicely with each other. They're not perfect, but they correlate very well. So that flux is a reasonable proxy for the other two measures, growth rate and fitness. And then finally, you could say, well, they just got better to the lab in general. How do you know it's, you know, growth on methanol and not just the temperature or the media? I'll come back to the media a little bit, or some other aspect going through these cycles, et cetera. And so the nice thing, if you look at the growth rates in methanol and succinate, the bluish purple and the magenta, for wild type, this is the engineered ancestor that is specifically bad in methanol. There's a relatively small effect in succinate. These are evolved isolates at generation 120 and at 600, and the methanol fitness has, you know, nearly tripled, whereas, you know, the effect in succinate has been modest and relatively inconsistent. So almost all of the adaptation has been specific to this particular environment. Not all. I'm not at all expecting that we're going to be able to explain all of adaptation, but at least most of it appears to be specific to the substrate, which was a promising start. And so, of course, one wants to know, what are the mutations that allowed this rapid adaptation? And so our first approach, before we did anything further, was a candidate approach, the introduced pathway. It was already kind of pronounced guilty before the experiment started, and that this is a very reasonable place to think that you might have beneficial mutations, either there or kind of, you know, physiological functions that directly interact with it. That was our hypothesis. And so looking at the introduced pathway, we chose out just a couple strains, and look to see if we could find any beneficial mutations. We were in a time crunch trying to put in an update for our grant, and luckily we found beneficial mutations. And interestingly, these were IS insertions, so insertion sequences, transposons, mobile elements, that inserted into, this is our introduced plasmid, they inserted into TRFA, which encodes the necessary plasmid replication gene, and they actually were in the catalytic domain that's required for replication of the plasmid. And I don't know about you, but this sounds like a very strange beneficial mutation to kill the plasmid that bears the pathway that you need. But this was the sequence. This is what we had to work with. There were some other kind of strange results that we couldn't reconcile until we realized that's not exactly what happened. There was this insertion, but then there was recombination between our introduced plasmid and the endogenous plasmid, so we end up with a co-integrate of a large 45 kb plasmid and our smaller 10 kb plasmid. And so, yes, the plasmid's replication machinery has been killed, but the larger plasmid has stolen our genes and put it onto this replicon. And what effect does that have? It affects the expression of the glutathione pathway. And I'll get to that in a second. So you can say, all right, this is kind of crazy. but it was actually two out of two that we saw had this particular, there were different IS insertions, but the same exact kind of event. And so another student, Mickey Lee, so most of this is work of David Chow in the lab, a great graduate student, and another is Mickey Lee. And so she wanted to look more broadly to see, you know, do you ever see this anywhere else? And so this kind of heat map relates kind of the prevalence of various IS genotypes, this exact type of genotype, and each of these boxes are different populations, so there were eight replicate populations, and then through here is time. And so, and every single row is a different allele, at least one allele, because we could distinguish it by having a different PCR amplicon length. And sometimes they were in the forward direction, sometimes in the reverse. So essentially the message is, every single population saw this happen many, many, many separate times. So chances are all these are beneficial mutations. And as I mentioned, in a large enough population, not all the beneficial mutations get to win. So in some of these cases, they went to fixation. In other cases, it was completely lost. And other beneficial mutations won out. But this is something where even at a single locus, there was tremendous what's called clonal interference of different beneficial mutations fighting with each other. And even this was all insertions within kind of a 200 nucleotide window within this plasmid. And this was either recombination or perhaps even just simply an incomplete transposition in the first place. And these are not the only mutations that we saw affecting the introduced plasmid. Besides various IS-mediated events, we've also seen deletions of regions that have to do with replication, and also mutations that affect transcription or translation of the introduced pathway. And so we have a wide variety of different genotypic events that appear to all have very similar phenotypic consequences. Kind of that first step of mapping genotype to kind of the biochemical phenotype, what they do to the enzymes, in that they all reduce enzyme activities by about twofold on average. And this leads to an 18% growth increase. And so this is a fairly, you know, in the world of evolutionary genetics, this is a decent selective coefficient. But in this case, it's by reduction of enzyme activity. So what this says experimentally is that there's actually an intermediate optimum for enzyme activity for this pathway. Because remember, no pathway, you're dead. You know, and the ancestral levels you grow, you can, if you reduce by a half, you grow 18% better. How well does the model do? Well, this is the case where the model completely and utterly fails. Because in the model, if you have a pathway like that, you know, all those curves were monotonically increasing curves. There should be no reason within the confines of thinking about, you know, a kinetic model of metabolism why more enzyme should be bad, except for a few situations of what's called branch point effect. But so, what does this mean? I think here, in this particular example, we need to, you know, there are assumptions that need to be questioned, one of which is flux all that matters? Because there could be other reasons why less protein would be a good thing. And these are now hypotheses. So even though the model failed, it allows us to now ask new questions. So now we're asking whether this can be explained by cost of protein expression. So I put this foreign pathway under just a bleedingly strong promoter. So maybe just simply the cost of expression. So if you have a flat benefit curve, but your cost curve really quickly goes up, if you put those two together, you're going to get an intermediate optimum. Another possibility is that the enzymes bind up too much glutathione, which besides being used for this system, is important for maintaining the redox balance of the cell, protecting against reactive oxygen damage, etc. And so now we're going after these alternative explanations. And so I mean, it's important, although kind of the goal of metabolism is flux, flux is not everything. The, you know, enzymes matter for other reasons, in terms of metabolites or in terms of enzyme levels. So so I'm going to talk about, instead of a diversity mutation, talk about one focal isolate that we spent most of our time on and that we've done sequencing of. And this particular one had a mutation that affected the glutathione pathway. It wasn't this weird IS integration type, but it had a deletion of what actually is the ribosome binding site immediately upstream of the second gene within this pathway. So we knew this one mutation was present, and we wanted, before we had gotten to any sequencing, we wanted to look at more. And so my student David had done some preliminary microarrays to look at changes in gene expression. And it was literally just a single array, one spot, comparing the evolved isolate to the ancestor and compare the ancestor to kind of the wild-type cells with the original pathway. But of course, you know, so we're not going to make any big story out of one spot, but it is still data, and so he still looked at it. And sure enough, he saw things that looked interesting that went up or down. And he said, I want to go after whether there are mutations in the promoters upstream of these operons that went up or down. I said, David, you know, this, people have tried to do this. This never works. You know, who's to say? I mean, it could be artifact, it could be indirect, it could be so many things, you know, mutations in a regulator rather than the promoter, but you know, it's really cheap and easy. So pick six and give it a shot. So he did, and he found four mutations, all of which are beneficial. He picked six more, got zero. And it turned out those four he found were half of the total mutations that were present. So he feels this is kind of like, John Henry versus the machine. He feels like he beat the Celexa pretty well. But so we found a number of very interesting things based on these mRNA results, and this is from a strain that it had adapted for 600 generations. One of these is a mutation in the promoter upstream of transhydrogenase. So what's that? Transhydrogenase is an enzyme that interconverts NADH and NADPH. And as many of you may know, NADPH is the cofactor that typically is used for biosynthetic reactions. NADH is typically oxidized by the electron transport chain and goes for energy. And so various pathways are going to make these at various levels, and transhydrogenase is kind of a physiological buffer that allows you to kind of keep these things in check. But just like a currency exchange down at the airport, it does cost you, in this case a proton, to go from NADH to NADPH. And so this mutation was a SNP in the upstream region ahead of the two genes that encode transhydrogenase. And what's important about transhydrogenase is that unlike the original pathway that oxidized formaldehyde that can make either NADH or NADPH, the new pathway I brought in, although it's largely similar, it only makes NADH. And so the cells actually stole the only way the cells reasonably have to make NADPH besides transhydrogenase. And so, sure enough, this beneficial mutation increases enzymatic activity 3.7-fold over the ancestral level. And so now this gives us a chance to kind of quantitatively test our model again and ask, what does this curve look like? And not only does this curve actually have slope at current level, it predicts if you go out 3.7-fold in enzyme activity that you'd have an 8% increase in growth. What are the data when we move the allele in? 12%. Now, like I said, this is a model. 12 and 8 are not the same number. I don't blame you for noticing that. But in the spectrum of possible predictions, if you look at all the other enzymes, almost all other enzymes, the prediction would be like 0.01%. And so relative to most enzymes, this is actually not bad. Like I said, I think this is a reasonable starting place in terms of saying that the model is at least somewhere within the range of being reasonable. And the nice thing, too, is this is not the introduced pathway. This is a chromosomal locus present before my engineered transfer that allows the new pathway to function better. And it has this direct link to the introduced module in that it shares the cofactors and the need for this introduced module to generate reducing power for biosynthesis. And we found an identical SNP in one of the other populations, but the other six do not have promoter mutations. They might have other mutations that affect transhydrogenase, or it may have only occurred in some of the populations, at least thus far. So this was one that we were very excited about. So what else did we find? The other particularly interesting one was a mutation in gamma-glutamylcysteine synthetase, which has to do with glutathione as a cofactor. And so this enzyme, is the GSHA, is the first step in glutathione biosynthesis, and it's known to be the rate-limiting step in systems where it's been studied before. And again, it's a promoter mutation. In this case, a deletion of two nucleotides upstream of GSHA. And so on the arrays, we see that the mRNA level has changed by about fourfold over the ancestral level. We have not yet, but we're in the process of applying techniques to actually measure the intracellular glutathione concentration. Why would this be important? As I mentioned, glutathione directly reacts with formaldehyde and makes the next intermediate that this introduced pathway actually metabolizes. And so the experimental data, this mutation causes a 44% increase in growth by itself. This is a huge beneficial mutation from the evolutionary genetics standpoint. And what's the model prediction here? Like I said, we don't know actually how much glutathione concentration has changed. What I can say is this is the most sensitive parameter within the entire model is changing the glutathione concentration. This immediately showed up as being a very potential target, and sure enough, this is at least the largest effect mutation that we've identified so far. And so again, this is yet another chromosomal locus there before the pathway was introduced that has a direct link to it and that carried a beneficial mutation allowing it to function better. And in this case, we see promoter mutations in three of the eight populations. Again, it's not, at least a promoter mutation, it's not present in the others. Given such a large beneficial effect, I wouldn't be surprised if there isn't some other mutation that's kind of a phenocopy that leads to the same outcome, because certainly increasing glutathione is substantially important for the cells, it appears. So there's one more mutation I want to just very briefly mention, which is we saw another IS-mediated event where a mobile element jumped into the promoter region ahead of two hypothetical proteins. They look like membrane transporters. And what was interesting is we had known that every so often, our media wasn't as good as it is in other times. And it appeared to be due to their trace metal mix, and that occasionally the trace metal mix was a stress. And through, it turns out that these mutations we've seen in two different locations cause, in this bad media with where the metal is a stress, insufficient metal, that they grow substantially better. But it has relatively little effect in good media. And we've tracked down this appears to be due to insufficient cobalt, and it's a sad story, so as to say, about how our trace metal mix, depending on how much light exposure it received, changed how much EDTA chelation was there and changed the availability of metals. And so it actually needed to see some light to be able to have enough metal available. So media that's made in, you know, the same bottle, you know, put one bottle in the dark, one in the light. The one in the light, they'll go gray. The one in the dark, they won't go well at all. And now we know other ways that we can achieve the same effect and they can grow well. But in terms of kind of, you know, turning lemons into lemonade, we've followed this. And what's remarkable is 30 out of 32 populations from other work, every single situation where methanol has been involved as a selective is a compound that they're growing on, 30 out of 32 have this exact same IS jumping into this exact same promoter region. And like 26 of them are in site 1 and 4 of them into site 2. And so almost every single population has this mutation. And remarkably, you know, it's this mobile element jumping into the same spot, always the same one. I'd say, a pretty incredible case of genetic parallelism. And what I think is really neat is it also is a case where we were able to annotate gene function due to finding beneficial mutations. And because what's really interesting is if you take these genes and you delete them, they actually have a very, very small effect. They only grow 2% worse. You never find this by transposon mutagenesis or anything else. Not even, you know, knockouts have hardly any effect. But beneficial mutations have led us down the path. And I think that this is important in terms of thinking that in terms of understanding biological systems in general, perhaps letting them get better is a good complementary approach rather than always trying to break them and make them worse. And so we're now, sounds great, so we're now applying Celexa to do whole genome resequencing. And so this allows us to get 5,000,036 base pair reads. Actually, only about half of these are of quality that they align to anything. And I won't talk too much right now if people are interested in issues of quality. This is a chart showing every single bacterial genome, and if you broke up their genomes into word links of all potential sizes, how long does it need to be to get, like, what percentage would line up uniquely? And it turns out by the time you get to, like, 20 mers, for essentially any bacterial genome, you'll be able to find, you know, essentially all of the mutations, align everything uniquely. Except, and the only reason why they don't asymptote to one is some of them have a lot of repeated elements. And so there is no such thing as a unique site there. And so we can capture most of the genome, and so we can get things that look like this. The original genome, it's hard to see, has a C. This genome has a T. And so the nice thing is Celexa very easily allows us to find mutations, whether they be SNPs, small indels. The IS insertion, we knew about ahead of time. The data are there. The analysis is not yet ready to be able to find new insertions. We found large deletions, and it turns out one of the endogenous plasmids did go missing in this strain only that we've seen so far. So the very last thing I'll mention is we want to look at interactions now between mutations, where rather than thinking about just one mutation at a time, how do they combine? Two mutations are going to affect two different, you know, enzymes. How now does the combined effect of both of these changes affect the flux and the growth rate? And we can quantify this as what occurs in the double minus the product of the singles, where such that the kind of the null hypothesis, a value of zero would mean each mutation has equivalent effect irregardless of background. And we can make predicted, it's very easy to do epistasis in the model. You can just do all the, you know, the combined effects. And so we can predict what epistasis should look like and make genetic interaction maps. But since we don't have very much of this data yet, you know, I wouldn't read anything too much into such things. But we have at least a handful now. We have three mutations that all affect the C1 hub. And so we made all combinations. I mean, all with 3 isn't that many, but it's 8 combinations total. And we can measure, you know, the relative increase in growth rate and or fitness. And so these are the selective coefficients of the that we obtained for all the single mutants that I've talked about, and the one that the model can address and what its prediction was. But we can also look at the combined effects. And so the green is what we actually see. The purple is what you would calculate based on the experimental data of the singles. And then this orange is what the model would predict given what we see, given the parameters that have changed. And so in general, there are a couple things. First, all these mutations were beneficial on each other's background. But in general, the green is less than the purple. That most mutations, well, you know, all, you know, 3 out of 4 so far, it's obviously a very small subsample, you get less than you expect. It's good, but it's not as good if it had happened on its own. So we see what's, quote, called diminishing returns, on average about 20% less. Interesting also, all the alleles that we found in this experiment are neutral with the ancestral pathway present. So these are specific to evolution with this foreign pathway being present. And what's really, I think, probably almost the most important aspect of this whole slide is just these 3 mutations that all had to do with the C1 pathway, the 3 aspects that I talked about today, they account for 85% of the total fitness increase. So most of what happened, at least early on, when we sunk them down in this fitness well, can be explained through changes that have to do with the subsystem we care about. And so I think this is very encouraging in terms of being able to use this system in this way of thinking towards being able to predict adaptation. And we saw, you know, rapid adaptation. Resequencing can readily identify the genetic basis, and for what it's worth, the Broad Institute charges me $1,500 for evolved isolate. And I tell you, relative to the time involved to find all those mutations any other way, $1,500 is remarkably cheap. And so far, the model's batting kind of 2 for 3 in terms of being able to deal well with the physiological basis of the beneficial mutations. And optimizing flux into biomass as kind of a proxy for fitness is fairly reasonable, I think, is a starting place. But it's certainly not the whole story. Proteins, like I said, are important for other reasons, too. And so I think that this has been rather encouraging in terms of being a system and kind of an approach to begin to address this broader question of can we end up predicting the targets of adaptation based on a physiological understanding of the cell at its current point in time. And so I would like to thank most of all my collaborators, Daniel Segre and Chen Chao at BU, who, like I said, are co-PI on this grant, a number of other collaborators, and most importantly, this is funded by the NIH and certainly would not be possible without it. And I'll leave with a picture of my lab. Everyone from my lab has to have, from my building has to have a picture in front of the BioLab's rhinos. So. And I'll take any questions. Absolutely.
In terms of where do you see this field going in terms of understanding how organisms react with one another, interact with one another, or in a disease situation with the human phenomenon?
Do you accept credit cards? That's perfect. So actually, we have another. Huh? Oh, sorry. The question. You know, this is one bug in one environment all by itself. What about multiple bugs together? And so, in fact, we have such a project underway, and I've got. So we're actually starting such a system. And so I
John talked, I came up right before the talk. This really dumb joke that I use it very image to where things going
more than just one bug at a time. And I said, you know, what does a microbiologist call studying 2 organisms at the same time? Contamination. You know, we don't do it. It's like fundamentally, you know, what the field doesn't, you know,
very, very far from it. So I'm interested in kind of pushing the other direction. And so you go from 1 to 2 I mean, already that, I mean, we have no idea physiologically how bugs seem to work with each other, not to mention kind of the ecological and evolutionary conditions that come into play. And so we started a project where we're evolving a novel consortium. And so the members might look somewhat familiar to you now. Who's heard of methylobacter? And E. coli. And so I've got a situation where E. coli is eating the carbon source and methylobacter is eating the
nitrogen source. So
they have to work together to be able to grow, and this does in fact work. But the thing is, cooperation is not just a discrete trait. It doesn't have to be kind of prisoners to limit either do or don't help you. It can be quantitative. And so we're looking at this is kind of an arranged marriage of two different bugs, but it's similar to many real microbial systems where you do have these sorts of interactions. And we're asking, how does this evolve? And do you see evolution of cooperation, an actual kind of altruism, giving, that comes at a cost? And same environment that we did, if those flasks, the prediction from theory, it certainly would be to be true, is you will not see kind of helpful giving in flasks. Because if nutrients, the currency of the interaction are the nutrients that are being exchanged. If there's just one nutrient pool in total, there's no reason to be any more, why should I throw extra money on the table after dinner with a lot of people? Why do I benefit from it? But if it's local, if you have population subdivision. And so we're looking at how spatial structure can affect the evolution of cooperation. And actually, one of the collaborations that I mentioned is a group at UT Austin who done a similar thing with E. coli salmonella and found the answer. That they would drop a soup cooperator of salmonella that would give the different metabolic interaction, but would give extra and have an advantage on a plate, but a disadvantage of the food. And the neat thing is that system is actually completely compatible with our bug, and so we think we can actually do a three-way mutualistic interaction. And so this person is actually going to come and work in the lab in the future. So, yeah. I think there's, in terms of taking the approach that I'm talking about, you can imagine kind of make, if you know kind of what systems are under selection in the two different bugs, you have models for each of them. This is going to be obviously now you have two systems. You might have to make it now spatially explicit in terms of diffusion of nutrients. It's hard, but I think it's also, think about how simple this is. If you can't understand two and how two things evolve together,
That's ridiculous. Oh, it's not working? Now that works.